Welcome to the Bulwark Daily. I'm your host, Tim Miller. Before we get to one of our guests, I've got two more favors. I did a favor earlier this week, and the response was overwhelming. The amount of emails that Katie Britt's chief of staff has gotten about her total absence and abdication of responsibility when it comes to the children that we are keeping in detention centers, even though they're trying to self-deport, it was at least noticed. Unfortunately, Katie Britt hasn't done anything yet. She did go on Fox last night and smear Muslims, but she hasn't done anything to help the people in the detention centers yet. But hopefully that will continue. I heard from some of you that you didn't like fully have the names of Fred East and Edgar Yana and how to spell them. So I'll put them in the show notes. If people did not get a chance to contact Katie Britt's office, please do so over the weekend. My other quick favor is this podcast is going to do great in the algorithm. Okay, the algorithm loves Trump derangement syndrome. The algorithm loves my guest. The algorithm loves it when we talk about Melania having press conferences. We're going to crush, okay? When we talk to Julia Curley about a trans woman being fired, and we talk to David Wallace Wells about climate apocalypse, the algorithm doesn't love that serious material as much. So if you liked one of those podcasts, my favor for you this weekend is think about a friend who might like it and help expand our reach. Send, I mean, the Julia Curley podcast just knocked me on my ass. So if you would send that with a friend to a friend who you don't think listens yet, I would consider it a favor. So I appreciate you. And then now you guys, I owe y'all too. So you can ask me for a favor. All right. Today's guest, an old pal, a lawyer. He used to be a Republican. He used to be a candidate for Congress. He's a Bulwark contributor and maybe a little bit more soon. We'll be talking about that. It's the great George Conway. Hey, George.
Hey, Tim, how are you?
I am pretty good. I mean, all things considered, I got my wish. All week I've been saying, if the Natalie Harp discourse leads to an impromptu Melania press conference, it will all be worth it for me. And I got my wish.
I was always there. I was always there. You just weren't paying attention. I've always at the White House. I'm very, very busy. You know, they tore down the East Wing and now it's a military bunker and I'm in charge of that.
Mr. Epstein did not introduce me to my husband.
Mr. Epstein? Who is that? Who is that? I do
Melania's
not know a
back.
Mr. Epstein.
She made her first public appearance in more than a month yesterday. Last time, if you even call it an appearance, was at the World Cup final. She was announcing, it's hard to understand, we'll play it, apparently a scholarship program for young adults in foster care, which is an admirable effort. Partners on the initiative include Fox. So that leaves me a little skeptical.
I don't know why.
But she came out at the White House, and I just want to play a little bit for you.
Good afternoon. I heard you missed me. Here I am. Welcome to the White House. A warm welcome to our distinguished guests today, Mr. President, my father, Mr. Knaus. Education is the one asset that can never be taken away. It is the foundation upon which confidence is built, opportunities created, and the future is invented.
Her English is not great. I know that like important that immigrants learn English in this White House. It's an important part of the Stephen Miller, but foundation, inventant, I don't unclear what's happening there.
Her English is better than your Slovenian, so I don't know what you're talking about.
She might be non-lingual. She's forgotten the Slovenian and not quite learned the English. So we have a non-lingual first lady, possibly.
I mean, you know, I don't criticize her for, I'm not going to criticize her for helping kids get education, I guess, but kind of timing. The timing was kind of interesting, don't you think?
The timing was interesting. And I guess I do have one criticism about the comment. There was the education is the only asset that you can't take away. That's actually not true in a free country. I mean, Donald Trump might think he can take everyone's assets,
take anything
that he wants from anyone, but you know, in a free country, you have an asset, you are actually allowed to keep it no matter what. So it's just a little quibble. Yeah, the timing's interesting coming off the Natalie Harp
thing. You sound like some kind of conservative or something.
Coming off Natalie Harp, we have more letters which we're going to discuss, but we all speculated that Melania was not going to like these stories, none too much. I don't know what she's doing the rest of the time, maybe just surgery? Where is she? It's not like she has, there's a lot of spotted.
No one knows where she is. Has she been in New York or has she been in Florida? I don't know. We don't really know. We need a Melania
tracker.
Do you
want to do that job?
Not really.
Okay.
But, you know, I'm sure the Bulwark has some people out there who would be willing to do that.
Yeah, we could find a volunteer.
For the country. Yeah.
All right. So that's Melania. She's back. She's still working on English, and she's concerned about Donald's behavior. I think with all her free time, she could improve it. I mean, it's been 10 years that she's been the first lady. The letters from Natalie Harp that might have led to this press conference keep getting weirder and weirder. The Daily Beast has some of the long form love notes. We'd seen some of the short form and the Swan Haberman book. I'm going to read from a couple of points. I'm trying to decide which parts to do first. The running is the funniest one, so we'll start there.
Yeah, make it dramatic, right?
Yeah. Several videos show Ms. Harp sprinting across great distances to keep up with Mr. Trump's golf cart as it putters around the course in Scotland. So we have those videos. Simultaneously to that, the letter says this: I'm also sorry if I was an embarrassment walking the course in Scotland. It's like, it's bore on the floor, is what this is.
Oh, I got to see the video. But
we need the video. Please leak the video.
Yes.
Some of the weirder parts, though, George. This is Natalie. We could be out on the course with no machines and even forget what time it was. I didn't have to be a human printer. I could take time to enjoy good conversation and still get all my work done at the end of the day. In fact, I even had time to take long morning and evening walks to enjoy each sunrise and sunset, though I did forget to eat and sleep. With so much thinking time, I confess it did have a slightly negative effect at times that I know you picked up on, but the end result, I believe, will be worth it. We go on. You have the absolute right to cuss me out if need be when I deserve it, because no one knows or cares about me more. They say I could not have parted with you to anyone less worthy, and I will add, it is I who is unworthy.
It's quite amazing. It's just it is just a peon of worship, and there's a bit of kind of like a hint of an abusive relationship there, yeah. Right? It just feels like, you know, he trashes on her, and then she does her best to throw herself back at him. I did not serve you well enough, master. And did you notice the – was there some interesting capitalization in that letter, or was it another letter that I saw?
Yeah, this letter, the human printer was capitalized. Sunset was capitalized. And then we get down to the end of this letter. I was saving this, but since you mentioned the capitalization, this is when the capitalization gets really weird. Thank you for being my guardian, capital G, and protector, capital P, in this life. That's what I wanted to use this card for. When you saw me at the cash register, capital CR, and once again did what you didn't have to and gifted me with mementos of this trip of a lifetime, a coming, capital C, of age, capital A, I will return a better person.
It's almost like she worships him as a capital D deity. Right? Capital G, guardian.
Woo! I was a little worried where you're going with capital D, so I'm happy we landed on deity.
That went over my head.
So keep going.
Capital P, protector. What was the other one? What were the other
capital
ones?
Capital G, like, guardian.
Guardian, protector, and then what was the cash register is interesting.
Cash register.
You know, she went to Liberty University, and someone pointed out to me this morning that cash register has connotations in the evangelical community. Cash register is a term that is used to describe people who treat the Lord as a kind of deposit institution where you do not good things so that you can get your, you know, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz at the end of the day. But it's usually, I think it's supposed to be critical of that mode of worship or belief. But she's saying, calling him the cash register? Is that the context?
Saw me at the cash register.
At the cash register.
I guess Trump probably just got her like a fucking like little doily from the Scotland, you know, golf courses pro shop. Like he got her some like Scotland socks maybe or like a golf tea ball that is inscripted with the course name.
Mm-hmm.
And that was for her memento of a lifetime, capital L, and a coming of age, capital C.
Coming of age. Coming of the Lord Donald Trump.
It's weird. I spoke to somebody who covers the White House, who was like, it's the type of situation where, you remember the old stories about Trump where he would do the thing, like a guy would come into his office in Trump Tower that he knew was having an affair, and then he'd like call his wife and put him on speakerphone and like say things like cryptically to kind of like embarrass him and scare him to manipulate,
torture
like,
him,
humiliate him. They're like, this is like the situation with Nat. Like, she's writing him these long love notes about how, you know, he is her sun and her moon. And for him, like, he thinks it's funny. You know, he could have a bunch of friends around and say, hey, Natalie, like, will you go poo in a bowl and then come bring it back to me?
Ooh.
And, like, she would do that. You know, like, I think that's the type of situation.
It is. It does seem that there is kind of that she's very subjugated in this relationship, that she's very... I hear, but the thing that also I'm wondering about is, where is this shit coming from?
Like, you think she might be a Russian spy?
I don't know. I'm asking that question without having an answer. It's a legitimate question, which I pose to you, the guru of bulwarkdom. Where the fuck is this? I mean, okay, so she writes these very personal private notes. She doesn't presumably make multiple copies of them and hand them out to the rest of the White House staff. She hands them to him. So where are these copies coming from? Who is giving them to the Daily Beast? Who is quoting them to Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan?
I've got a working theory on this.
Yeah, I'd like to hear that working theory. I mean, you're supposed to be talking, interviewing me and asking me questions, but I've asked a question. Yeah,
it's a podcast, George. It's a conversation.
Okay,
it's a two-way dialogue. Right. It's a weekend pod. You know, I unbuttoned a button. We're getting loose. Here's what I think. The Swan and Haberman book was very specific in noting that she leaves these for him. I think maybe there's something embarrassing about like handing him the letter. She's a little embarrassed. Maybe she knows somewhere in her subconscious that he's not reading them. Donald Trump doesn't read. Like they're very long. Like we'll put the link in the show notes. You can look at the letters. They're very long. Like there's no way in which he's reading these. I mean, Sam Stein was like, is she talking in code when she says cash register? And I was like, cash register is in paragraph 11. Donald Trump did not make it that far. So if there was a code, he didn't get it.
Yeah, I know. All right.
What this I think is happening is she leaves them around and there are people in the White House that hate her. She's the conduit by which people get things to Trump. And Trump gets things out.
Right.
So she pocket vetoes shit. You know, she prints out shit that they didn't want him to see. You know, whatever. Like, my guess is Susie hates her. Caroline hates her.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, they all hate each other. They're all very jealous of who has access to him.
So that's what's happening. Right. She leaves them around. One of them knows Trump isn't going to read it, picks it up, takes a picture, or just takes it for themselves.
And she's continually trying to fight the staff that's trying to keep her away from the president.
Right.
Right? I mean, that's why
she's
running.
Jumping in the trunk of the car.
That's why she's jumping in the trunk of the car, running past after the golf carts and so on and so forth. I mean, it was really, it harkens back, and I say this with the disclaimer that I do not believe that these two have carnal wisdom of each other. Because I just find that hard to believe in his current medical condition. I think... she serves a completely different function, which we can talk about. But it reminds me of the Monica Lewinsky episode, where in 98, if you recall, people in the White House basically knew that there was something on with this chick, Monica Lewinsky, and the president. And they were very suspicious of it. She was always around the Oval and at weird times. And so what happened in 1996 was that the chief of personnel in the White House, her name was Evelyn Lieberman, basically transferred Lewinsky out of the White House, seconded her, or I forget what the government term is, sent her over to the Pentagon to work in the press office, where she faithfully met someone else who worked in the press office at the Pentagon, one Linda trip, and the rest, of course, is history. That totally, completely backfired. You know, they wanted her away from the White House. And in fact, you know, I was one of the first people to hear, famously or infamously, the Linda Tripp tapes. And one of the things that's on those tapes is her bitching to Linda about how all the people in the White House wanted to get rid of her and finally succeeded in getting rid of her. And there's a little bit of that flavor here.
Yeah.
A lot of that.
You shared the tweet, which I did not remember this. This is, you lived this. I was a child.
Oh, I'm so old.
I do not remember this phrase. This is Don Van Natta, great guy, ended up being a sports reporter, but he had the scoop that Clinton wore a tie that Lewinsky had given him to a press conference as like a secret message to her to like behave during the grand jury testimony or something.
Yeah, that was a great story. Don and I are now friends, even though he outed me as one of the elves who wrote the Paula Jones brief, he and Jill Abramson, and on the front page of the New York Times, which got me in a lot of people at my law firm weren't real happy about that at the time.
But that seems, people being unhappy with you, colleagues, it seems like that's a running story of your life. Though.
Yeah,
so I don't
absolutely.
Know if you can blame Don about that.
But I did, you know, I mean, maybe I digress here. You can cut this out if you like.
No, please digress. That's what people are here for.
I found Linda Tripp, her lawyer. I never spoke to Linda Tripp, but I found Linda Tripp, her lawyer, and Linda Tripp's lawyer had to produce these tapes. So I think it was January 16, 1998, the day before Clinton's deposition. And so we're sitting in this lawyer's apartment because he needed to listen to the tapes to make sure he knew what was being produced to the government. We started listening to these tapes. And the thing I remember distinctly, I was eating a blueberry donut on the guy's living room table, and he's playing these cassette tapes on his stereo. And Linda is talking to Monica. Monica is bitching about how Evelyn Lieberman had her transferred out of the White House to the Pentagon, so she couldn't see the Big Creep, which was her nickname for Clinton. And
the Big Creep?
The Big Creep was her nickname for Clinton, the Big Creep. And then Monica tells a story to Linda about how she gets back into the White House one Saturday, or Sunday, and what used to happen, and this was in the Star Report, was that she would show up at the Northwest Gate early on a Saturday or Sunday morning, and everybody with the Secret Service, they'd let her in because she was authorized. Clinton put her on the visiting list, and then they would watch the little dot on their screens that showed where the president was. The little dot would go down to the Oval Office for their assignment or whatever they were doing. But anyway, she tells the story of the one Saturday or Sunday she did this, and she's bitching to Linda Tripp about how she was bitching to Clinton about they transferred me out of the White House to keep me away from you. And he said, I'm sorry. You know, this was 96. They felt they needed to do this because he's running for re-election. Yeah. Clinton saying, I'm sorry they did that to you. I promise I'm going to get you back here after the election. And Monica told Linda, oh, thank you. That's great. I said to the president, can I come back as assistant to the president for blowjobs? And
So, given your expertise in this area, you said something that piqued my interest, which was you don't think they have carnal interest in each other. You think she's serving another purpose. What purpose do you think she is serving him? Ego management?
Yes, ego management. But in the extreme. I mean, I think that's what she did. She helped keep him sane during the criminal trial in 24. And that's how we all got to know Natalie Hart for the first time. She was there in the courtroom every day. I was in the courtroom in the back with Norm Eisen and the gang, and we're watching these proceedings, and they would come in every day. And she would print stuff out. At one point, she printed stuff out about me, and Boris Epstein handed it to, for some reason, Caitlin Collins. But that's how we got to know her. And what she did was she printed stuff out to bring his spirits up. When somebody said, oh, he's so good, he's so smart, he's going to win the case. That's what she does. He lives in his own little world at this point, right? He says all these things, like, you know, on the podcast with Cohen last night, he says all these things that are just completely untrue, like completely fanciful, like Iran was 2 weeks away from a nuclear weapon. I would win by 25% today if I ran for re-election. All these things are just, He actually, I think, has gotten to the point where he has convinced himself of his lies, which is what happens with malignant narcissists. Narcissistic sociopaths, gradually they just begin to believe their own bullshit because the truth is too painful for them. And that is the function that she serves, is to indulge his fantasy world where he lives apart from reality. And, you know, that is the significance of Natalie Hart. And that is the danger of Natalie Hart, is she is the ultimate enabler of his psychosis. I mean, he is psychotic at this point. He is not perceiving reality the way reality should be perceived. I think he really does believe this is the renaissance of the American economy, that we are going to control the Strait of Hormuz very soon, and it's going to become the 51st state. I guess, I don't know if water can become a state. And that's her function, is to make, she's enabling and extending his psychosis, which is kind of a bad thing to have with a president of the United States.
Also sounds a little nice, though. I don't know. I mean, if Katie or Ansley or Jason were telling me that, you know, they're unworthy, that I'm their guardian, that I'm wonderful. Yeah. I would love that. I mean, nobody does that to me.
Of course. I know, but that's the thing is, and he desperately needs that because he is such an extreme narcissist. It reminds me of, and I should write a blog post about this, I'm restarting my Substack. There's a writer named, a famous psychologist named Eric Fromm, who talked about malignant narcissists like Trump. Great evil people of history were malignant narcissists. And they're basically says, They tip into psychosis. They're basically psychotic because they want to believe the fantasy world in which they control everything and everything is about them. And that's where Trump has always been headed. And I think at this point, he's not even close to reality. And that's just a scary thing. And we just, you know, and that's the thing that a little bothers me about the Natalie Harp episode, is that people are treating this as a debate about whether it's a low blow by the Democrats, a low blow by Ossoff, and we're really talking about, we're maligning a poor young woman, and we're talking about this on basis of whether or not they're having sex, when in fact, I think JV wrote it the other day, that would be better if they were just having sex, because it would just be, at least you could understand that. At least it's in the realm of normal human comprehension, but this is psychotic on both sides. That she worships him as some kind of deity, and he sucks that up and is,
so to speak,
using her as a tool to create and maintain his own fragile reality that is being tested each and every day throughout the world and in reality.
OneSkin is nothing like your typical skincare brand, and that's why I keep coming back to them. Most anti-aging skincare is built to react, smooth over lines and wrinkles after they show up. OneSkin started somewhere different, working to address how skin ages in the first place. Founded by four PhD longevity scientists, they studied skin at the cellular level and found that visible skin aging starts deeper when certain cells stop working the way they should, and that begins affecting the healthy cells around them. So they engineered OS1, their proprietary peptide, to work with skin's biology, targeting those dysfunctional cells instead of just sitting on the surface. It's the foundation of every product they make. And what you see over time with their products is firmer, smoother skin, more tone and radiance, and visibly fewer fine lines for skin that both looks and acts younger. When I hear the word radiance, you know what I think about? George Conway's skin. Let me tell you, you can go back in the archives, all right? Before George Conway started doing George Conway Explains It All with Sarah Longwell, go find the very first episode, okay? Before he had a sponsored skincare brand. Look at his skin. Now, fast forward to today's episode and look at his skin. Unbelievable. He's glowing, okay? Straight men of any age, get on it. Start moisturizing, all right? It works miracles. And our friends at OneSkin are the miracle workers. Born from over 10 years of longevity research, OneSkin is helping you unlock your healthiest skin now and as you age. For a limited time, try OneSkin with 15% off using code BULWARK at oneskin.co/bulwark. That's 15% off oneskin.co with code BULWARK. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. We're going to get back to Michael Cohen, but you mentioned your work in the 90s, and I think let's just be 90s Republicans for a second. Like, you know, whatever, we were that. A couple of news stories happening this week with this party. The debt officially hit $40 trillion on Wednesday. A new high watermark. The national debt has grown by $11.6 trillion during Trump's two non-consecutive terms, more than any other president in history. At $20 trillion, he said it was catastrophic for the country and needed to be resolved. He was going to fix that in 2016. And then famously, Elon Musk came in this time talking about how big of a catastrophe this was and, you know, how he was.
And then balance the budget.
Yeah, he was going to be the one man to fix it. He ended up just killing a bunch of kids in Africa and then keeping us on the trajectory of the highest debt in history. How worried should we be about this?
I think we should be extremely worried about this, particularly in an interest rate environment that is not favorable. I mean, the bond markets are tanking. Interest rates are going up because people fear inflation. They fear that they don't trust our future anymore. And what happens is if you have more debt and the rate to refinance, you know, as treasuries come due, the bond markets decide how much people are going to pay for treasury bills. And if they're willing to pay less and interest rates go up, the debt goes up because we're paying more and more interest on the debt. And that's what's happening. It's a very much a downward spiral. And I think, you know, we saw J.D. Vance pretty much acknowledge that the other day when he was saying, why do we want to be the nation, the planet's reserve currency anyway?
Right.
And people are fleeing the dollar, they're fleeing treasuries, right at the moment where we need to sell treasury bonds to finance these massive deficits that go on. And that's just an astounding thing. And I mean, I think when Barack Obama left office, the national debt was something like $25 trillion. So in 12 years, mostly, I mean, 10 years, mostly because of him.
I think it was like 20 even. I think it's double.
Yeah, it was. No, I remember I used to, in one of the things I used to do on Twitter early on when I started going off on Trump, there's this account on Twitter called National Debt Tweets or National Debt Posts or something. And they basically every morning, every weekday morning or every day the market's open, they publish their estimate of what the U.S. debt is on any given day. And I used to tweet like, okay, here's what it was on January 20th. 2017, and here's what it is today. Today, it's just astounding. It's just absolutely astounding, and it's very, very scary.
My message for Democrats on this, because I do think that there is, this is stupid, but, you know, the country is stupid. I saw somebody posting the other day something like, you fiscal hawks have been warning about this since the 90s, that Social Security is going to become insolvent, that we're going to become Greece. It's like, well, no. Actually, in the 90s, people were mostly saying, you know, around 2030, where Social Security is going to come insolvent and things are going to be out of hand. And so we're coming up on 2030. But I think people are sick of hearing about it and people don't think anything that it matters and that anything's going to be done about it anyway. And obviously, speaking of narcissists, the boomer and Gen X narcissists don't really seem to care about what it means for their children and the budget that they're going to lay for them. So what I think the Democrats should do and how people who care about this should talk about it is the bond market is complicated, but understanding what your mortgage rate is on your house is
yes.
Right. And just be like, look, guys, like whatever you think about the national debt, like if we keep these deficits going, you're going to keep paying this high percentage on a new home. You're not going to be able to get a new home. You're not going to be able to downsize. Your kids aren't going to be able to get a home. Like it is directly tied to the housing crisis. And I think that's probably the best way to maybe have a breakthrough.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think somebody has to start taking responsibility for this, and neither party has done that over the years. I mean, the first of all, Republicans really didn't mean it. All they meant was to do was to cut the budget when a Democrat is president, and then they want to cut taxes for their friends when a Republican is president. When any responsible person, including, you know, so they used to be people who really did believe in fiscal responsibility in the Republican Party, when they would propose something, they would absolutely be skewered by the Democrats by saying, you want to put children on the streets and so on and so
kick
forth.
Kick granny off the cliff.
Yeah, kick granny off the cliff. And I think both parties overall over the last 50 or 60 years have really contributed our inability to handle our fiscal responsibilities. I would say the one time in the 90s, when you talk about the 90s, that was the one time where we actually balanced the budget or came close to it, or we actually achieved some level of fiscal responsibility.
It was lockboxed.
Well, no, it was really because of the peace dividend, right? Because the collapse of the Soviet Union meant we had to spend less. We didn't have to try to have a 600 ship navy like Ronald Reagan wanted to, and we cut military spending because we didn't need to have as much. All of a sudden, we had pretty much a balanced budget, but we couldn't stick to that. And the Republicans deserve every bit as much criticism, more than that, of the Democrats. I mean, you look at the spending versus taxing for the two Trump administrations, it's just completely out of whack. Biden was fiscally responsible compared to Trump, and he had to deal with COVID too. Yeah. So, I mean, it's not great.
Hey, guys, the Good Fight Tour is live for everybody now. Tickets for the Good Fight Tour headed to ACC country. They are live for everybody. So let's go hang out, be together. The tickets are available at thebulwark.com/events. Sarah, JBL, Sam, and I will be coming to Columbia, Charlotte, and Atlanta on October 16th, 18th, and 20th, respectively. We'll bring some other Bulwark friends with us as well. That Columbia show is going to sell out fast, baby. It's a small venue. We're going hipster. It's indie. You know, it's like seeing a big band go back to the small club. And we're going to be partying. It's a Friday night, South Carolina. So if you want to go there, get your tickets today. Check out thebulwark.com/events to see what other Bulwark friends are bringing to your city and other details. Hope to see you there. The wall might be down, but Soviet beef pricing is coming to America. Trump leaded this morning. For the next 90 days, the United States will allow up to 300,000 metric tons of product for ground beef to be imported with no quota tariff. We have a commitment that this beef will be sold at 25% below current market prices. I should note that the tariff is 26%. So, that's an interesting number that this beef is going to be 25% below. Is it going to be because the tariffs make things more expensive, or is he going to undercut the ranchers who are working in this country with this foreign beef by price fixing?
I never understood Trump mathematics, and I don't think the banks that ended up being claimants in bankruptcies for the Trump casinos understood Trump math either. But I think at the end of the day, he's going to claim that he cut beef prices by 600%. Mm. That's what I think he's going to do.
That sounds right. Kind of like the pharmaceuticals, yeah. He is very socialist. Like, he's our most socialist president. And the types of this is just the one example, the cutting of the beef prices. But if you just go through, I mean, like, the most obvious examples is the taking, you know, stakes in Intel, et cetera. Yep. But, you know, we have the secret police on the street, like, across the board.
Trying to determine whether or not media mergers should go through, taking tributes,
bullying executives into doing what he wants, or else he's going to punish them with tariffs.
Then taking credit for their successes when they decide to build a new factory or create more jobs. He says, that was me. I did that. Yeah.
It's frustrating for them to be like using this moment to be like the Democrats are communists when he's running the most kind of state-run, like Cold War-style socialist government we've ever had.
I mean, you know, this is why I always believe that people were right when they said, you know, when politics isn't necessarily right to left, it really is more of a circle where the right and the left, the far right and the far left, meet at the top of the circle or the bottom of the circle, however you may see it. And that's right. I mean, he's doing things that if AOC, President AOC or President Bernie Sanders even thought about it, even mused about it, the right would go batshit, and people would be listening to Fox News go on and on with hammers and sickles and whatnot for weeks. But you know, if our leader our great leader does it, our great orange leader does it, it's okay.
An interesting little, just small item of resistance that was happening against the great communist leader happened a couple weeks ago, and it came from Judge Box of Wine, Judge Jeanine. This is when Trump was trying to order that an Olympian be put into a gulag because yeah. Trump imagined that he was the one that sabotaged his great reflecting pool, and Judge Pirro, or now Jeanine Pirro, not a judge anymore. It's kind of a, I still like to call her judge kind of in the Judge Judy.
So. I like Judge Box of Wine the best.
Judge Box of Wine.
Although she came in with Judge Box, she came in as Judge Box of Documents apparently.
Yeah.
Day, which was impressive.
I mean, do we know what is the latest with this? Do you have any thoughts on that?
You know, there's litigation about whether or not the dismissal should be with prejudice. The government, sua sponte or on its own, made a motion to dismiss the indictment without prejudice, which the lawyers for the Olympian thought was unfair because that means that theoretically someday if Trump found a new U.S. attorney, or he could be this guy could be charged again for the same bullshit. And since the government is essentially admitting that the case was bullshit, the dismissal should be with prejudice. I think an argument that's very, very strong. Other than that, I haven't really ever heard, and I do, I mean, there was some tweeting, I think, or some Truth Socialing where Trump was suggesting that the U.S. Attorney's Office have another go at the guy, which is just insane.
Where are you at on just the Blanche DOJ and kind of fear level? You know, I'm always grappling with this on the revenge part of this administration, which contains like everything in this administration, you know, like one part malice, one part like clownish incompetence. And I feel like the revenge program has been more like nine parts clownish incompetence, one part malice, like the seashells, everyone is walking free. You know, Barack Obama, Jacob Frye, Tim Walz,
Sandwich Guy, Letitia James,
Comey. Everyone walks Comey. Free still.
Everybody, the only person they caught that they got was Bolton, but that investigation actually began during the Biden administration.
Correct. So, and they were just like, what luck. They got in there and they're like, oh, shit. Yeah, somebody on the list was already did something bad.
Yeah, he did something, but what he did was he wrote notes and kept his own personal diary that contained classified information or references to classified information.
These guys are really running a tight ship on that, I bet.
Right. The guy, right. So the guy who actually took crates of boxes of documents, like tons of documents, a room full of documents, to his personal club in South Florida and then hid them from the FBI, had his lawyers lie to the FBI about the documents and move them, and tried to destroy camera footage of the moving and the concealing of the documents. He's the president of the United States who basically encourages this prosecution. Can't make this stuff up.
My guess is the printer has some classified documents that she's not been handling appropriately. I mean, the additional reporting that Maggie did that was, you know, since the book was like, one of the other reasons that there were concerns about her is that Trump's taking world leader calls and sensitive calls on speakerphone, and she's just there. She didn't have a full background check.
Yeah, and that's the other thing about that.
Not exactly a tight ship.
How do you go to work in the White House and refuse to have a background check? Repeatedly, she refused to undergo the background. She refused to fill out, I think it's the standard form 50-something that you're supposed to fill out when you apply.
It does make you wonder.
It does make you wonder.
She comes out of nowhere. Her brother's in Nicaragua. Is like a left wing freedom fighter. It's like was on CNN high as a kite, which is great. God love him. But it's like she comes out of nowhere. All of a sudden, she's around him all the time. I don't know. It's suspicious.
Yeah, I don't think we've heard the last of this actually.
Back to Blanche, really quick though. Like, what's your concern level? I guess about the last 2 years. When it comes to political prosecutions, all that.
Well, I just think we're going to see more of it. I mean, Blanche clearly does not give a shit about the rule of law. He doesn't give a shit about whether or not the Justice Department is used as a kind of weapon by the president. He basically is openly declaring that he will do whatever the president wants. Now, he's right in the sense that the president is the ultimate, you know, executive, and I don't think you have to believe in the unitary executive theory that gets liberals all excited to believe that, you know, at the end of the day, the president is responsible for what the Justice Department does and does not do. The thing that the Justice Department has to do is to provide justice and to lead to justice. And part of that process, in order to act as the enforcer of the laws, you have to show that you're enforcing them fairly. But he does not want that to happen. I mean, I think the fundamental problem isn't that we have a unitary executive theory that has run amok. It's really the fact that we have an executive who doesn't believe in obeying his oath of office and doesn't believe in the law and doesn't believe in the Constitution and doesn't believe in government as anything but a weapon to boost his own finances and ego. That's the fundamental problem. The fundamental problem with Blanche is he's good with that.
Yeah.
He's absolutely good with that because he wants whatever he wants, which is he to be Attorney General of the United States, to be important, to be powerful, something he never was. You know, he was just sort of a middling former assistant United States attorney with a not so, this mediocre criminal law practice until he met Donald Trump, and now he's Attorney General of the United States. You know, that's what happens with these kakistocracies, is that mediocre people rise to great power because they are willing to do what it takes to satisfy the whims of an exalted sociopathic leader. And that's classic authoritarianism. That's Blanche fits right into that.
Yeah. What's your level of alarm about the 2028? The thing that has me the most alarmed right now that the Blanche ties into is just, you look at the power ministries and it's like, you got Blanche, Cash, and Hegseth. And it's pretty strange that Hegseth and Cash are the two that haven't been fired. Like,
yeah.
You kind of look at the incompetent people, they've been pushed out of other areas, but not there. And man, I don't know. That's the one thing that has my spidey sense tingling a little bit, besides the bunker he's building at the White House. Just so, like, he has his most loyal hackish people at Justice, Defense, FBI.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that he's going to pull some shit, even maybe before this year, in conjunction with the off-year elections. And I think he's going to pull some shit in 2028. I mean, this man who launched an insurrection in 2020. One, I agree with you. I'm very worried about it. And what worries me most about it is there is, and I think the Democrats are going to do well in the midterms, but there is just sort of this lethargy, this sort of acceptance of our fate among people who consider themselves as opposing Trump. And you see it everywhere. It's just like, well, we can't do anything about Trump. We should be worrying about affordability. It's like, well, how are you going to do that when this guy is starting wars that raise the price of gasoline and imposing tariffs that raise the price of consumer goods and food? And they want to pretend that Trump doesn't exist because they feel that he's convinced them that they can't do anything about him. There's this kind of learned helplessness, is what psychologists would call it. Mm-hmm. And because of that learned helplessness, we reach this kind of, again, what psychologists would call a malignant normality, where we're accepting things. We're accepting like a Watergate-level scandal every week. He does something that's just incredibly, would be paralyzing of an administration for a month or two or a month or end an administration. But he, it's just... it's Tuesday.
There's been some conversation about Resistance One figures falling on hard times. You know, Michael Avenatti went to jail. I want to get into that broader discourse, yeah. But there was a particular example of this that you've already mentioned, which is the current president going on to Michael Cohen's radio show. Before the last presidential election, he said that if Trump ever returned to the White House, he would change his name and flee the country. He's called Trump a racist, con man, everything. Yet last night he played Why Can't We Be Friends by War and then welcomed Donald Trump to the show. And I want to play a couple clips of Cohen.
You and I have obviously traveled a pretty rocky road together. You remember, sir, when I went on CNN with Brianna Keeler and she told me that you were underwater in the polls and I responded with those famous two words, says who? So maybe what we should do is then have a press conference and literally put out all of the accomplishments, because what's happening... Boss, you remember when I was by your side?
Boss?
Boss!
It's kind of like a fascist Uncle Rico situation.
I gotta say, they outdid Saturday Night Live there. particularly with the lead-in and the sycophancy, it was a parody of itself. I will say this also at the same time. While it was amusing, I mean, the absurdity of of the suck-uppery and then the lead-in, which where Cohen made it all about himself. It's not about the country, about what Donald Trump is doing to the country. It's about the last 10 years of about his relationship, his personal relationship with Donald Trump, and now you get to see the reconciliation. And it was all about him. Very, very narcissistic. It was comical, yet at the same time, a few minutes into the interview, it was boring because Trump has this flat affect now. He's low energy Don, and he's just repeating the same bullshit over and over again. It's like, oh, they were 2 weeks away. Iran was 2 weeks away from a nuclear weapon. And then Cohen's like, wow, why don't you tell the world that? That's amazing. This is a new revelation for our program. He even said that on CNN yesterday that, oh, that's a really big revelation about Iran. It's like, no, no, no. They made that argument months ago and everybody laughed at it because it wasn't true. And then, you know, Trump is saying, I would win by 25 points today if I were running for re-election, and the economy is in a new renaissance. We've got more jobs. It's better than ever. And Iran no longer has a nuclear program, and we're going to control the Strait of Hormuz. Huh? You know, again, it's all very, very delusional. And the whole thing is just this exercise in reciprocal narcissism. What was interesting, I thought, too, was there was an interview that Cohen did yesterday, late in the day, on CNN with Jake Tapper. And he basically admitted there, Cohen, he says, I haven't asked the president for a pardon, but he expressed great disappointment, which he has done in the past, with the fact that he applied for a pardon during the Biden years, and he had people like Jamie Raskin and Norm Eisen and lots of other people, liberals, saying that he deserved a pardon, and the Biden
gullible liberals, because right. Fuck them. Sorry, I don't know. You did the crime, you do the time,
yeah,
Michael.
He did the time. So I don't really, you know, It doesn't.
Kind of. He was on an ankle brace in the house.
Yeah, and he was denied the pardon, and then of course, Joe Biden pardoned Hunter. I can't say that Michael is completely wrong in being resentful of that. I think his completely being obsessed with that and being very angry and letting it rule his life is excessive. But he comes in with that attitude, and then he also feels tremendously exposed when his former boss becomes president again, because my God, he's going to be high on the shit list. So he immediately starts turning, pivoting. And Tara Palmieri, I was on with her last night on Anderson Cooper's show. Tara Palmieri basically said that Cohen asked her for the president's phone number, because every journalist in town has it, and said, I know how to get back in his good graces. And he did. And the way it is that you listen to the guy and you pretend he's right and you say you're sorry. And they weaponize me too, the way they weaponize the
have
government
some
against
dignity.
You.
It's pathetic.
It's just like a pathetic
little lapdog. It's so degrading. He's like laughing. Remember?
Yes.
Remember when we did this? It's fucking
right.
Embarrassing.
But Trump eats it up. It works.
I know. But here's the thing. If I felt like Michael was pulling the wool over Trump's head and he was pretending and he's faking it and he was using Trump's narcissism against him, I would be against that. I could accept that, whatever, this is a strategy.
Right.
That's I looked at that video. People can turn on the YouTube version, and he is giddy. He's like a giddy little Yorkie. What kind of dogs do you have? He's a corgi.
I have a corgi.
Like
corgis
a giddy little corgi.
Corgis aren't giddy.
Remember how much you like me. Please pat me. Please pat me.
Yeah. But that's Michael Cohen. That's my point about Michael Cohen. I mean, look, you have two narcissists, right? Trump is the most extreme narcissist you will ever imagine, and he is a malignant narcissist because he's a sociopath and he wants to destroy everything deep down psychologically. He's a very, very dangerous man. Michael Cohen is just your run-of-the-mill ne'er-do-well narcissist.
Idiot.
Who just wants to be in the thick of things, just feels that he's never gotten his just desserts, and he's just looking for a home. He wants somebody to love him. He is like that puppy dog that you just described that needs to be loved. And that's, to me, that is pathetic. It makes me feel sorry for Michael in a way that I could never possibly feel sorry for Donald Trump. And I'll tell you a story, which I mentioned last night on CNN, which is, he, you know, he's looking for affirmation wherever he can get it, this guy, Cohen, right? He didn't get enough affirmation from the left.
he got a show on the Midas Touch Network. I don't know. He did pretty good.
He did, but it wasn't enough for him. And then, and now he's looking for affirmation wherever he can get it. I'll give you an example. And I don't say this. I like Michael in the sense that I feel sorry for him, and I don't have anything against him. He's always been nice to me. So I, you know, looking at it from that narrow perspective, sure. I don't want to go out and dump on Michael. But here's a funny story. You know, I had my ill-fated run for Congress earlier this year, and we announced it on January 6th, and Michael kept contacting me. And he wanted to help my campaign. He said, let's go out for coffee, let's walk the streets together, let's you know, people like me on the East Side, they'll see you, and that I can help you. And it sort of amazed me, because I remember getting off the phone with him, and then I'm looking at my phone, and I'm seeing some kind of alert for a news story that says that Michael Cohen is now claiming that he was pressured into giving the testimony at the Stormy Daniels trial. And I was like, what is going on here? And I didn't think he could really help me politically. You know, I was very flattered and grateful that he was being nice, but it was like, it was totally weird, because you could see him, he was in the middle of his pivot, and he wants to help a guy whose basic platform is that the president of the United States should be impeached and removed and then prosecuted and sent to jail for the rest of his life instead of spending it on a Qatari-donated 747 and in the White House in a ballroom.
Amen.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he just wants attention. It's sad. It's a pathetic situation. Would you do this? How would you handle this? I don't know. Hypothetically, let's say, anti-Trump, pro-democracy YouTube channel provided you a show in the future. Would you be interested in having the president on?
Oh, absolutely. And I was ready to say that on Anderson's show, but the conversation didn't get there. But I wanted to say to the president of the United States, look, I expect to be starting up a new podcast with something like what you just described. I don't know where it would be. I don't know what kind of organization there would be that would have such a podcast. I don't know. And I would love to have President Donald J. Trump as my first guest.
Are you going to spend the time reminiscing about all the good times you had together?
Oh, my God, about the E. Jean Carroll case. And I love talking about the psychological aspect of things. I've become kind of an amateur psychologist. I'd love to talk about the Montreal cognitive assessment test, the one he keeps taking and the nature of it with him and ask him why he's been taking that so many times. And of course, we would talk about Natalie Harp and the important functions that she serves with him. And I agree, Mr. President, it's crazy that they're saying that you are having sex with her. We know that couldn't possibly be true.
Medically,
yes.
Great. I hope that happens. We're rooting for it.
Yeah.
Just to close on a serious, like, because I have some thoughts about this. You know, it was never like the hipsters that were the Trump resistance. You know, like there was always like a category of people obviously the people on the right hated the resistance. There's always a category of people on the left that would like talk about this as a pejorative, you know, MSNBC resistance wine moms and like they do is orange man bad. And so after Alex Vindman, I've got nothing but love for lost, you know, his Florida primary, you know, they're lumping you in, they're talking about Cohen. There's a lot of people that are kind of saying like, your resistance one is over, you know, that didn't work or whatever. Like, what do you say to that critique?
I don't know exactly what their theory of it is, but I do think there is something to be said for the proposition that people are exhausted by Trump, including people who oppose Trump, and they don't want to hear about Trump. And one of the things that I was fighting over the last several months, I mean, I had a lot of problems. My problem was like, you know, look, to make an argument that you're not a politician, only a good politician can make that argument and win. People don't want to hear about Donald Trump. Even people who say they despise Donald Trump, they do not want to hear about Donald Trump. They want to close the in, which I can't blame them because it's unpleasant, but it just gets us deeper into the hole. We're sleepwalking into it. into situations get worse and worse, and we're getting more accepting of it. It's the narcissism, as you say, of the baby boomer and Gen X eras that people just, they just like, I'm going to just focus on my own thing. I'm going to focus on my job. I'm going to focus on my social media. I'm going to focus on everything ESPN. I'm going to focus on everything but politics. It's just a lot of noise. And that's very, very dangerous to our democracy. And that is actually what scares me more than having Kash Patel and Pete Hegseth in the power ministries, as you describe. The apathy, the complete lack of historical perspective that we are at a stage in our democracy of decline, that people don't want to face up to that, and that people want to turn away from that and don't want to engage in the kind of collective action that's necessary to turn things around. That, to me, is the most dangerous thing about the current moment.
I agree with the danger, but it's a weekend, so I'm going to end on a positive. You want a positive?
Okay, positive,
Here's what I think about this discourse. I think that some of it is silly, social media talk, and it's personal jealousies and beefs and whatever. And I think there are two good things that have happened and are happening. Number one, to all of the resistance folks out there, to the Women's March, to the No Kings people, if your guiding North Star the last decade was the orange man is bad, and that's the most important thing that faces the country right now, you were correct.
Yes.
And you keep being proven correct.
Yes.
Every time, everybody thinks that is proven correct. If you go back to 2016 and you find like the most caricatured, outlandish, kind of, you almost want to roll your eyes at it, op-ed or commentary piece about what is going to happen if Donald Trump becomes president.
It's been 50 times worse.
It's been worse. That has been totally vindicated.
Okay.
So I think everyone who's involved at all in any resistance, whatever number we're on, should feel vindicated about it.
Absolutely.
And eventually we'll win.
Absolutely.
I think
I agree
simultaneously
with you
that. To that, I think it's totally rational for Democratic voters in a primary to look at Donald Trump having won a second time and think, we need to do new shit. And I don't think that's bad either. Like, I think that's both those things can live together harmoniously, that there is a continued fight against Donald Trump that we need people like George and others for over the next 2 years. And also the Democratic Party needs to kind of assess how it got into a place that voters wanted him again and maybe try new strategies, new things. Both those things are true. And I don't think that they need to live in conflict with one another.
That's right. I mean, I don't want to go all JV last on everybody.
Okay.
But, you know, what I just said and what you just said, I think actually coexist.
Right. Because we need more of it, actually.
We need
more people that are doing that are, you know, that are engaged.
And it may well be that things have to get worse before they get better.
Yeah.
And I've felt that for a very long time. But the problem is we're so far beyond the moment where I thought everything would turn around and people will say, basta.
We'll end on basta.
Basta.
George Conway. We appreciate you. I think we'll be hearing more from you soon. We'll see how that goes. Everybody else, enjoy your August weekend. It's about back to school time. I had to send my girl back to school. It was emotional.
Aww.
And so enjoy, you know, these final August weekends. We'll be back on Monday. Bill Kristol will be back. So
awesome.
All will be warm on Monday. We'll see y'all then.
Okay,
thanks,
bye.
George. Bye, everybody.
I've seen you around for a long, long time.
Yeah.
I remember you when you drank my wine.
Why can't we be friends? Why can't we be friends? Why can't we be friends? Why can't we be friends?
I see you walking down in China.
The Bulwark Daily is brought to you thanks to the work of lead producer Katie Cooper, associate producer Ansley Skipper, and with video editing by Dante DiCicco and audio engineering and editing by Jason Brown.